Hey, y'all. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Iranian-American film director, producer, screenwriter, and actress Desiree Akhavan has made films that divide convention and break stereotypes, all while making you laugh, cry, and occasionally wince along the way. Akhavan is best known for her 2014 feature film debut, Appropriate Behavior, and her 2018 film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize. It stars Chloe Grace Moretz as a teenager sent to a gay conversion camp. Her newest project is a series for Hulu called The Bisexual, a six-part comedy-dramedy which offers a raw, funny, unapologetic take on bisexuality. Season one of The Bisexual premieres on Hulu on November 16th. But New Yorkers, this one is for you. There's a special screening of episodes one and two tonight at NewFest, the New York Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Film Fest. And I'm happy that Desiree Akhavan is in our studios. Hi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. I want to talk about The Bisexual. I watched the whole thing, and it's amazing that you wrote it, you directed it, and then you were in the lead role of Layla. So we meet Layla at a time in her life. She's got just a lot going on. She's starting a new company. Tell us where she is personally in her life.
So when we meet our protagonist, Layla, she is with her partner of 10 years. And they're about to launch their tech startup, which is a business like a Shazam for clothes. When you can, if you take a photo of someone's outfit, it'll tell you where to buy it or something similar. And it's an idea my co-writing partner had, and I thought it was brilliant. And her partner proposes to her, and she says no. And the rest of the series is sort of piecing together. You know, what if the life you built isn't the life you want? And what is it to be unapologetic about your desire as a woman today?
And Layla has only been in homosexual relationships. She hasn't been in a heterosexual relationship. And she sort of has this moment of, well, is this something I want to explore? Yeah. And that's a big overarching theme. And there's this great moment in one of the episodes I want to play for people where she and her friends are kind of discussing what bisexuality even means. So let's listen.
She's in a cab. It would have been really weird if I took her home, right?
You have to stop with the straight girls.
I think she's bisexual.
Sex tourists. All the girls you date are sex tourists. Does anyone know an actual bisexual?
I'm pretty sure bisexuality is a myth. Yeah, that it was created by ad executives to sell flavored vodka.
I think the girl I'm dating might be bisexual.
Yeah?
Yeah, the girl I was talking about. So she and her friend get intimate.
When they're out drinking with a group of people or when they're alone and sober?
Out drinking.
She's perfect for Beth.
Sexual tourist, that's the best. So there is that idea that you are tackling all of the things that people think, maybe they think to themselves, maybe they don't say it out loud, about bisexuality.
Yeah. I think it's about sexuality in general and specifically, I mean, I'm bisexual, I should say. First of all, I should say the show takes place in London, which is why everybody has an accent except for myself. I've been living there for the past 4 years and my writing partner lives there. So I am bisexual, and the first time I found myself doing press for my first movie, Appropriate Behavior, I heard myself introduced as, you know, the bisexual filmmaker, lesbian, oh, sorry, Desiree Akhavan, the bisexual Iranian-American filmmaker, Desiree Akhavan, or, you know, the bisexual Lena Dunham, Desiree Akhavan. And I didn't mind that they called out my sexuality. It shows up a lot in my work, and I'm not ashamed of that. If they had said the lesbian filmmaker, I would have felt a lot of pride. But for some reason, hearing the word bisexual felt like nails on a chalkboard. It felt deeply shameful and embarrassing. And I wanted to explore why it is true about me. I am bisexual. And yet there's something gauche about that title. And that became the seed of this show, is exploring what is it about this that feels so taboo, and why do I not want to associate myself with that label?
There's an interesting foil to all this is Layla's roommate, her flatmate, because she and her partner take a break. Her longtime partner, and his name is Gabe, and he is sort of the butt of many jokes about the patriarchy and white privilege, many of them earned, but yet he is her confidant.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about creating that relationship and why that was important to have, because in a classic rom-com, they would end up together.
Exactly. So Gabe is a love letter to my brother.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I'm really close with my brother. He's 5 years older. He's a surgeon. He lives on the Upper East Side. my opposite in politics, in all things. But we have so much respect for each other. And in a lot of ways, he's my eye into the straight world, and I'm his eye into women. And that's the relationship we wanted to see on screen. I didn't want to make a queer show that alienated everyone and that there was no endpoint if you weren't yourself part of that insular queer group. And also, Layla's taking a step out of that group. So where does that leave her? And the only non-judgmental space there is a blank canvas like her straight male roommate. And I think to me, it was an opportunity to explore what is that perspective of, especially in the time of Me Too, the straight white man. What is his ballad? And I think there's a lot I wanted to explore about masculinity and the pressures of it, of modern day masculinity, and what was this man fighting against? And I think what I love about his character especially is that when we meet him, he's a stereotype. You know, he's a novelist who now works as a professor. He had a breakout hit in 2005 with his debut novel and was never able to match that success and fell down very quickly as he rose up, and has been living this almost potential for so many years. And over the course of the season, you get to see where all his vulnerabilities lie and where his lack of courage lies and his responsibility for the women in his life and where that manifests itself. And that was interesting to me, to see what is someone who comes off as such a joke at first glance. What if you got to know him over the course of 3 hours? How would you feel after you met his sister, after you mm-hmm. saw his nephews, after you saw, and one episode takes place in the past and you see his first love? How would you see him differently in those idiot remarks that he makes in episode one once you knew him a little better?
We're speaking with Desiree Akhavan about her new Hulu series, The Bisexual. Yeah, it's interesting because Layla also gets a glimpse into what it means to be married and committed with children through Gabe's sister. Yeah. And it's an interracial relationship, so she has biracial children. And there's this one great scene where Layla gets up and starts to dance with the kids, whereas Gabe still just looks really pained by the whole domesticity of it all. What do you hope is unique about Layla's perspective as you wrote this, that you wanted to make just really unique to her character?
I think what's unique to Layla's character is that she doesn't swallow what the trajectory you're supposed to be on. I think she's looking to be honest, even when it's painful. And it's one thing to come out of the closet. It really takes courage, especially for this character, because she's Iranian, like myself. I came out to my conservative Iranian parents at 25, and it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. And it really broke me and broke my family for a while. But I came out as bisexual, so this isn't exactly my story. But what was interesting to me dramatically was, what if then, after earning that, after going through that kind of pain and putting yourself to reinvent what it is to be a family, what if you went again and complicated that further and said, it's not that simple? I think people can wrap their brains around what it is to be a homosexual now, saying, oh, the way I feel about the opposite sex, you feel about the same sex. But with bisexuality, there's still something quite uncomfortable there. It's harder to relate to someone who doesn't have gender as this defining factor. And what's interesting about Layla's journey to me is going against that norm that we've established of what it is to be homosexual and say, actually, it's not as clear cut for me, the straight or gay thing, that I'm somewhere in between. And I want the space to pursue that in my 30s. I think there are very few stories about female sexuality and female pleasure specifically. I grew up with so many examples of what it is to be a man receiving pleasure, but felt very much on my own in inventing what it looked like as a woman. And I think it ends up looking very selfish and self-indulgent and slutty and negative when you see a woman on a sexual explorative coming-of-age story. And that's something I was committed to with her and with this show. It's a lot about sex and bodies and relationships, and that's something I wasn't watching on screen.
And to that point about being about sex and bodies, and you meant use the word honesty, the film is very honest about the way people's bodies look.
Yeah.
And what bodies are like when you're having
It's sex. My body. That's the thing. I'm not a model. Like, I specifically put my body out there, and it's super vulnerable. But I didn't grow up seeing anything like myself on screen, from my ethnicity, being Middle Eastern, to my body. I was literally voted the ugliest person at my school. I mean, I'm not an ugly person, but I can't even
put my brain around that one, actually.
But there was a contest at Horace Mann, where I went to school.
Oh,
exactly. Once you heard the school, you're like, that makes sense.
Can you hear an eye roll?
It's an eye roll.
Sorry, Horace Mann, but you know. Anyway, go ahead.
But it's important to me to see the world as I see it on screen. And I think that's, and I don't think of that only politically. Yes, it's political, but also it's good storytelling. I'm so tired of seeing the same stories and the same bodies, and one girl gets exchanged for another younger model as soon as she's like reached a certain age. And also, I think it's hotter. Like, imagine there's a reason why amateur porn does better online than the highly orchestrated stuff. When it feels real, when it feels tangible, when you see flaws, when you see skin color variations or scars, acne scars. I mean, that's the stuff of life. And that, to me, makes art so much more heightened, because it's breaking down that that wall between you as a viewer and them as performers, and it's still heightened, it's still something beautiful, but I think there is beauty in the banal.
And you also see Layla's evolution through that flashback, because we see her in a flashback and her hair is straightened because she's trying to fit in and she's a little bit heavier and she's trying to figure it all out. Why was it important to show young Layla to you, for people to really sort of go on this journey with her?
It felt right to introduce our characters, that when we meet Layla, she's in a like a 14-year friendship with her best friend Dennis, who runs her parents' off license, which is basically like a bodega in New York. And they're very different classes, different lifestyles, but best friends. And I wanted to have that origin of how they fell in love friendship-wise. The same with Sadie, her partner, who's 10 years older than her. When you meet all of these people, I'd wonder, as a viewer, how did they find each other? They're all such different, it's such a melting pot of a very different group of people. And Sadie, her long-term partner, is white and from the North. It's a completely different background. Like, where would they find each other? And they allude to it a little bit in the opening scene of the show. But I thought, how great would it be to watch? Because they tell the story in the opening of the show, they tell the story of how they met and they watched Trainspotting one night. And then you go in episode 5, we go back in time and we see them meet and we see them watch Trainspotting for the first time. And we see her meet Dennis, her best friend. And there she's Dennis's first lesbian friend and the first person she comes out to in 2005. And so it was important to watch all of them have those happenings or those meetings that ended up dictating so much of their life in 2018.
And there's an important line in that scene when someone says to Layla, "Oh, you're American." She goes, "No, I'm Iranian." Yeah. What was that signaling?
Well, it's very subtle, but it was important to me to put in how much my identity is made up by the fact that I was raised by Iranian parents in this insular Iranian community in the tri-state area. But then also that to be an immigrant's child is to be from nowhere. You know, the Iran that I was raised with is an Iran, a pre-revolutionary Iran that no longer exists. The Farsi I speak is antiquated. When I speak to young people from Iran now, they're like, "You sound like my grandma." The terminology I use, the formality, I always use the formal because I was only taught the formal way of speaking. So I sound like an old lady. But I also, you know, especially living in London now, I can see I'm very much a product of being raised in New York, too, that there's this headstrong, they call it confidence in the UK. They're like, "Well, you're quite confident," or brash is a word. And that is very much a result of being from New York. So I can't avoid being American.
But you have chutzpah.
From New York. Thanks, Moxie.
We're speaking with Desiree Akhavan about her new Hulu series, The Bisexual. I read in an article that you took this series, this idea, to pretty much every network in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And some of the responses were shocking, but at the same time, not surprising. Will you share some of those?
For sure. So every single network said either, I'm so sorry, this is great, we love it. I mean, they say they love everything, so who knows if that was genuine. No one likes to be negative in Los Angeles. In that way, it is the opposite of New York. But we love this so much, but we already have a female-driven show, so it's just bad timing. Or we love this so much, we already have a queer show, and we don't want to cannibalize our own business, so come back to us in the future. You know, and every mentor I had, every person in my life who had done this at a better, higher level than I had, advised me to give it up and just start a new project. And there was something in me that felt like this was what I had to make, and that didn't at all feel like an option. And that even if I was going to self-fund and put it on the internet, on YouTube, and find it some way to pay my bills, I just really wanted to tell this story. And so I ended up just moving to London I was just going to stay for a few months to co-write The Miseducation of Cameron Post with my writing and producing partner. And then I pitched this out there because her husband had the idea too. And so I did it. And the next thing I knew, I had a choice of where I could make this show. And all the conversations I was having in London were very much about how far my imagination could take me. I think that the industry is tiny, and what fuels it is the content rather than the commerce. So, you know, there's not a lot of money to be made, and the budgets are super modest. However, creatively speaking, I had a very long leash.
It's interesting when you hear you talk about someone told you no, but you didn't take that. You know, I think about in your life, or I think about my life, times people have said, no, I'm sorry, you're not right. No, I'm sorry, this isn't going to happen. What is it that just makes you keep going?
Well, first off, I'm not capable of anything else, which I'm sure you can relate to. I would do anything else if I could do it, genuinely. And this is a weird calling where you're just, and I've just known from a young age, I don't function. I wasn't a good student. I'm not particularly bright in any area of my life, but for this is home. More so than any city's ever been, more so than any person's ever been. My work is my home. But then also you just get this sense, this gut feeling of, okay, this isn't my partner. When someone says no, they're not your people. And it's the person that you get under each other's skin and yes, and each other. Like mm-hmm. when I met my exec in the UK, I brought her this idea and suddenly she was like, oh, this reminds me, we should look at the casting of High Maintenance. They do such great casting. I love the way they tell their stories. And I was like, yes, yes. And that makes me think of this other thing. And we just kept bringing more ideas to the table. And suddenly it didn't feel like work. It felt like gossip. I think good mm-hmm. writing should feel like really fun gossip. Whereas when someone says no or is seeing a wall, it's like it feels like homework. And you're like, okay, then this isn't the right way to do it. So you're right. No to this. No to us working together.
Right. You need to find people who nourish you.
Yeah.
And help you move forward, and you help them.
And it has to be mutually beneficial. Mm-hmm. But yeah, of course, when you first hear no, it feels like a confirmation of every worst fear you have about yourself, you know, late at night when you're staring at photos of yourself that are unflattering and reading mean things. Yeah, that feels bad.
What is next? Will there be a season two?
Inshallah.
She asked, hopefully.
I hope so. Yeah, I have an idea for season two, and I feel very hopeful that it'll happen. Yes, I see what I love about this show and the idea of working in television is you can invent the rules for yourself. And with season one, even that flashback episode, that was such a one-off and a weird idea and so outside the form. Whereas I think with cinema, you're very much telling, you have 90 minutes and one story to tell, and you tell it however you can get by, but you can just have so much flourish. So my dream is to do a season two and to pick up at a completely different stage in everyone's life. And for as many seasons as we can do, look at those different chapters and how, you know, I think every 5 years in my life, at least, the circumstances are completely different.
The name of the series is The Bisexual. It premieres on Hulu on November 16th. Desiree Akhavan, it was a pleasure to have you in studio.
Thanks for having me. And I just want to plug again that tonight we're having a premiere of episodes 1 and 2 at Newfest at the SVA Theater in Chelsea. And I believe there are tickets available.
Excellent. Coming up after the break, we're talking to author and historian Neil McGregor about his new book, Living with the Gods. It explores the significance of religion and systems of belief to society, spanning, you know, the last 40,000 years. Stay with us. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. He gave us the history of the world in 100 objects. Acclaimed art historian and curator, former director of the British Museum and the National Gallery, Neil McGregor writes books that explain the nuances of history by examining objects and shared narratives. In his new book, Living with the Gods, on Beliefs and Peoples, McGregor takes us on a world tour detailing historic artifacts, rituals, places, and human behaviors to help understand how a shared system of beliefs can influence and fortify a society. Living with the Gods is also a 30-part animated radio series on the BBC Radio 4. McGregor's previous books include Shakespeare's Restless World and Germany, Memories of a Nation. Neil, thank you for coming to the studio.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm putting you to work right away. Would you please read the first paragraph of your introduction? I thought I could try to explain it, but I think it's much better to have you read it.
Just read out the first paragraph.
Yes, please.
Right, here we go. Living with the Gods is about one of the central facts of human existence. That every known society shares a set of beliefs and assumptions, a faith, an ideology, a religion, that goes far beyond the life of the individual and is an essential part of a shared identity. Such shared beliefs have a unique power to define and to divide peoples, and they're a driving force in the politics of many parts of the world today. Sometimes they're secular, most obviously in the case of nationalism, but throughout history, these narratives have been most often, in the widest sense, religious. This book is emphatically not a history of religion, nor an argument in favour of faith, still less a defence of any particular system of belief. But looking across history and around the globe, it interrogates objects, places, and human activities to try to understand what shared religious beliefs can mean in the public life of a community or a nation. How they shape the relationship between the individual and the state, and how they have become a crucial contributor, especially today, to who we are. For in deciding how we live with our gods, we also decide how to live with each other.
In the book, you say belief is back. If it is indeed the case, what components are missing that we need belief at this time?
What we're talking about in this book about belief is not an abstract set of ideas. It's about how a group of people construct a narrative that they can inhabit. Belief is about the conviction that the community you're part of will go on. We've moved to a view of belief as something for the individual, private spirituality. That's not religion. The religion that we're talking about in the book, the belief we're talking about in the book, is where a group of people together think, how do we want to be as a society now? How do we sit in the world? And where will our society be when we as the individuals are dead? That's why we need belief now, because I think it's pretty clear that what all Western societies are struggling with is a story of who we are, how we look after each other, how we belong together, and where we want to be in the future. It's that kind of belief, the narrative of what the community wants to be, that we're talking about.
Can we have that unified sense of beliefs when there are so many different kinds of people who believe so many different things?
That's the big challenge. But I think if one of the things I wanted to try to show by looking at objects and societies from across time is that every society that survived has had such a narrative. And of course, when groups of people have different stories, they fight. But your question, Is there a model for people with different beliefs, different kinds of people living together? Well, I think there is, rather surprisingly, it's ancient Rome. The ancient Romans had, of course, a system of many gods, as we all know. There was a Mars and Venus mm-hmm. and Jupiter and all the rest of it. But the great thing about having many gods is that you can always have a few more. And as the Romans conquered a new territory, they didn't try to send missionaries to convert everybody to worshipping Mars or Jupiter. They stayed with the gods of the people they conquered, and they added them to their gods. They took them in.
So they expanded.
They expanded the number of gods. The pantheon grew. And it was a wonderful way of making the citizens part of the bigger group, because you could honour their tradition. It's a very hospitable thing.
It's also rather clever, because then people don't fight you if you're welcoming, or you at least appear to be welcoming, of their culture.
It's clever, and it's maybe one of the reasons why the Roman Empire lasted for so many hundreds of years, able to keep expanding, always able to embrace new people, because not only did they honour the gods of Egypt in Egypt, they actually built in Rome temples to the gods of Egypt. And that's, I think, the great model. If you can really take the ideas of the people that you are now living with and publicly honour them, find a way of revering them, venerating them, then you're making your community bigger, and you're showing that everybody that comes in, that you've brought in, you're treating with the same respect, the same honour. It's much harder if you've only got one god, because it's more difficult to share. But there are models, and I think it's very interesting to look at the way the Romans did that and see what we can learn.
We're talking with Neil McGregor about his book, Living with the Gods. It comes in at just under 500 pages, and it's divided into six parts. The first part is Our Place in the Pattern. Part two is Believing Together. Part three is Theaters of Faith. Part four is The Power of Images. Part five, One God or Many, to the point we just made, talking about, Powers and Earthly and Divine Finish. Chapter one, Beginnings of Belief, is the first chapter. It begins with a 40,000-year-old object from the Ice Age, the Lion Man of Ulm. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Can you describe it physically and why you chose it as the very first object in your book?
This is a statue made out of the ivory of a mammoth tusk, and it's about 18 inches high. And it shows the body of a man with the head of a lion. And it's about 40,000 years old, made in South Germany in the middle of the Ice Age. Why it's so important, why it's so interesting, I think, is because it's the first evidence we have of human beings being able to make a three-dimensional image of something that can't exist. It's the first time that an idea beyond experience is given physical form. And that's a huge leap in our human society. These are, for the first time, people like us. It's Homo sapiens. They've got brains just like us. And what they're doing is combining the fiercest animal that they know in their environment, the lion, with the biggest animal they know, the mammoth. And these poor, small, weak animals, humans, have only got one thing. That's their mind, their idea, their intelligence. And the community of the Ice Age needs an idea to get through the winter, to get through the perils of life. And this extraordinary image and object is a very powerful thing. The lion is carefully observed, he's watching you. We can tell that it must have been passed round and round and round the group. The ivory is worn smooth completely. And it must have been part of a group of people sitting around the fire, handing it round with a story. Story about humans, animals, the world, the place. Somehow this is, we have to imagine what it is, but it's a story of how we together sit in the world. And all, and historians argue that that's why societies can survive things like the Ice Age, because they have a shared story of where they sit, what they're about, and one that goes beyond the individual. The fact that we have an object that can't exist and that we need it and we use it is so important. Because why do you make something that's not going to bring food, not going to bring heat? What it does do is something much more important. It gives you a story of hope for the future. That's what communities need.
In section two, Believing Together, you talk about the power of song. Specifically, you talk about Amazing Grace, which, of course, a lot of Americans know. I'm interested that you included Amazing Grace, given its history. I don't know if a lot of people know that it was written by someone who actually was initially a slaver, a slave trader, who then became an abolitionist later on. Why did you choose Amazing Grace? And is that story, is his personal story, important to your thesis?
It is. The Amazing Grace is in the book because it's the perfect example of what was one of the great discoveries of Luther. The question Luther had to face was, how do you get a group of people to think, to all to know the same story? His understanding of our relationship with God. And Luther has the brilliant idea that the way you do that is you turn Holy Scripture into rhymed verse and you give it a tune. He's the first person to realize that if people are singing the same thing, they are a community. And the idea that, because all this is about, what we're about in the book, Living with the Gods, is living as a community. The great community is a community of people who all know the same words and the same tune. That song of Amazing Grace was, of course, one of the songs that enabled a very important community that didn't have hope to have hope, which was particularly the Afro-American slave community, enslaved community. The fact that they had song and words of hope, and they could all share that, allowed them, without any formal arrangement, to be a kind of community. And the fact that it was a reformed slaver who realised the need for this, and that this was what could help people to survive slavery. And what I found so powerful is that Amazing Grace is, I think, the tune and the words that more American people know than any other.
I might agree with you on that one. It's interesting, as we're talking about all of this and belief and religion, we're talking with Neil McGregor about his book, Living with Gods, on belief and peoples. We booked your interview a long time ago, and obviously we've had a horrible tragedy in the United States over the weekend at a house of worship where people were sharing their beliefs. I just was interested in getting your reflection on that, given all that you've studied about religion and beliefs and societies trying to come together when we're at this incredibly difficult moment where 11 people lost their lives at a synagogue.
The killings in Pittsburgh are obviously a critical question in this kind of debate. And it's why this kind of debate is so important. Why does this happen? And this is a pattern that, of course, has been in Europe over the last 20, 30 years, more frequent, not just with Jewish communities, with Islamic communities, Christian communities. This is a profound question. And one of the arguments that I think I would like to present is that part of this is because we as a bigger political society no longer have a shared story. We're fragmented. And the individual is left more and more on his own, on her own. The community story, which is what we're talking about here, has somehow disintegrated. That makes, I think, many people very envious, very suspicious, very frightened of communities that still have a shared narrative of hope. Whether those narratives are Muslim ones or Jewish ones, the fact that there are communities that have a view of themselves with obligations to each other, obligations to the world, and a view of the future. That's very alarming, I think, if you don't in your political life any longer have a narrative of a community that embraces everybody. And that is clearly one of the crises in Europe and in America. And I think one of the reasons why religion has come back into the political debate, because this need of something, of a view of where we all are going together, that we've lost in our politics, many people now look for in religion.
Well, if you say church and state in the United States, then everyone wants them to be as far apart as possible. Is that even possible these days?
I think it's a real question in what sense it can be possible. It's a big question in France as well, which is a similar tension, and where France's difficulty with its Muslim population is one of the central themes of the book. Why is it so difficult? And I think it's there because France has a very strong notion of its national story. It has taken a nationalist narrative of identity, and it is uncomfortable with another one that challenges it and appears to offer a parallel identity. But I think to come back to a point of how one gets this to work now, the great model, I think, of one of these narratives that is worth thinking about because it shows so much is the way the Hindu communities in Bengal make every year a statue of the goddess Durga. This is the most wonderful narrative. Durga is a goddess who comes once a year in the autumn. She comes with the melting snows from the Himalaya down the Ganges, and then she eventually goes home. But once a year she comes, and she does the usual things that a goddess should do, like sort out evil, get rid of the wicked, and bringing society together.
I like her style.
She's your kind of goddess, I think. she's fierce, but she does good things. And every year in the autumn, the people of Bengal, in every community, every village, have to make a statue out of earth and clay that they paint, that she can, for a few days, inhabit. It's never in the temple, it's in the street. She's a goddess of the public in the street. And to make that statue, you need earth from every corner of the village, every bit of the town. And then you need two extra bits. You need a little bit of earth from the banks of the Ganges, the great life-giving river that flows forever, must be in it. And then, right at the end, the priest has to go to the house of the prostitute and ask for some earth. So that the outcast and the sacred are there, as well as the whole community. And only then, only when the rich, the poor, every bit of the community, the outcast, the holy, only when all that is together in the physical earth of the statue, will the goddess inhabit it. Just for a few days. And I think that's a wonderful poetic idea of stopping every year just for a day or two to remember that you can only have a really healthy community if you find some way of making clear to everybody that they're all part of it and they're part of the bigger story, whether that's Ganges or the priest or whatever, part of the bigger story.
It's a lovely, lovely way to finish this conversation. I love that. The name of the book is Living with the Gods. It's by Neil McGregor. You can catch Neil tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Morgan Library and Museum. Oh, that's a lovely space. He will be giving a talk about the book. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's 6:30 tonight at the Morgan Library and Museum. Next up, remember the Alfred Hitchcock thriller Marnie? Tippi Hedren is a calculating ingenue. Sean Connery is the creepy blackmailing cad who marries her. That is the same storyline. It's the subject of a new opera by 37-year-old Nico Muhly. We'll talk to him next. Don't go away. All of it will be back after a break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The story of Marnie encompasses thrilling safe heists, troubling psychological breakdowns, and questions about identity and who people really are at their core. Originally a crime novel by British author Winston Graham, it was later turned into a film by Alfred Hitchcock, starring Tippi Hedren and Sean Connery. Marnie has now been adapted into an opera that had its premiere at the Metropolitan Opera earlier this month. The opera was composed by New York-based Nico Muhly, who might just have one of the most diverse resumes of anybody working in contemporary classical music, and Nico Muhly joins me in the studio. It's nice to see you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
So funny, you said you've been in New York for 20 years, and you sort of were wandering around this neighborhood, and how much it's changed.
I know. It's totally... this is such a strange location for me, but I love it.
Well, we're glad you made it up to the studio safely.
My pleasure.
How familiar were you with the story of Marnie?
So I saw most of Hitchcock's movies when I was younger. My father was a big enthusiast, so I sort of grew up with them, So I was more or less familiar with the film, although it's not one of his best known ones. I've probably seen it, you know, once or twice or something. But weirdly, I've been reading the Poldark novels by Winston Graham because they had been on the BBC at that time. So I had him kind of on the mind. And when Michael Mayer, the director, called me up and said, "Do you know what would make a fabulous opera, Marnie?" I thought immediately, yes. And then hung up the phone and thought, well, we've got to go back to the book because the movie is so... I mean, like so many Hitchcock movies, I feel like you can watch them with the sound off and have an aesthetically ravishing experience. You know, you can argue that that The Birds is a movie about clothes, and that that North by Northwest is just about those shots.
About
those
angles, right?
And yes. It's just about angles, literally. it's just about those few shots where you think that's the most beautiful thing, the plot being kind of irrelevant. Mm-hmm.
So you said you got a call. Is that how you got involved?
In this particular case, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think my previous two operas were sort of my idea in terms of what the subject matter was. But this was a great surprise and actually a welcome change because it meant that essentially the director was already attached. He was already obsessed with it. And we could build the piece from the ground up together.
Do you have to be obsessed to get this kind of work done?
It helps, yeah. I mean, I don't think you could write something this big that takes so much time in your life if you weren't really willing to throw yourself into it.
And how long did it take all together?
It's hard to really say. People ask this a lot, mm-hmm. and I never know quite how to answer because so much of the work is preparation and study and thinking about it.
That part. Let's talk about that part.
That part. Well, so the phone call came in late 2013.
Okay.
And I was still kind of reeling in a good way from a previous grand opera at the Met, which mm-hmm. again, you know, it sucks years off your life. And so once we decided that Nicholas Wright would be a great librettist, we started bouncing things back and forth. It was slow and polite for a long time. And I started touching sort of pen to paper in terms of big structural outlines. Just what does the piece look like? You know, what's happening musically? That was probably 2015. So between then and when we premiered it in London last year, it was probably like 2.5 years, let's say.
Okay, that's a funny saying, slow and polite.
What
does slow and polite evolve into that, or need to evolve into?
Well, in this particular case, slow and polite is, you know, an email a week with drafts, and then suddenly once I'm setting the text and you think, okay, I need a different syllable here, this is too long, this is too short, I need help, I need this, I need that, then it's like me sending demos back and forth and you know, PDFs of the score and saying, you know, it would be really helpful for me to have another sentence here. So that starts turning into a frenzy, and it is kind of the only thing you can possibly do at that time.
We're speaking with composer Nico Muhly about Marnie, which is an opera at the Met currently. So a lot of people have, you know, you say Hitchcock and they immediately have an idea of what it is and what it's going to look like and what the vibe is going to be. Mm-hmm. Was that something you had to keep in mind? Because I am imagining that you want to do something unique.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like many adaptations of things that go into films, you know, the film has to privilege the visual in a really specific kind of way. And again, as I said before, with Hitchcock, my memory of those films is almost entirely visual. And with few exceptions, I'm not worried about what's actually happening. And in the case of Marnie, his adaptation, like his adaptation of The Birds, was really just about sort of sexually humiliating Tippi Hedren. There wasn't much else going on in terms of what he was trying to do. So what we did is we went back to the book, which of course is set in England and not in Baltimore or wherever she is, and her flashbacks are not based on color, it's based on actual memory and based on repressed information that comes out in psychotherapy. So once we decided to sort of jettison the film, it was very, very easy. Now, in terms of people's expectations, there's not much you can do. You know, and people, of course, come up to me after the show and say, well, it wasn't exactly what I expected. And you think, well, you know, I hope not.
You're like, great.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
Glad.
Thank you so much for your kind words.
Well, it's also, but in terms of the visuals, the costuming is so on point, I guess is how I would describe it. Can you explain to people what that looks like and why that's important?
So there's two different things to say. In terms of the physical set, what Julian Crouch and Mark Grimmer came up with was that it's a series of sliding panels that all can receive projection. And what that means is that you can end up with sort of five different textures happening at the same time in such a way that it looks like you've quickly looked around a room and then turned the whole thing into a Saul Bass record cover, was the kind of main design brief. So it's realistic, but in kind of shattered, right? And this is sort of the idea behind her, too, where she's obviously a real person, but there's a lot going on. And when she enters a space, she's simultaneously in disguise, trying to case the joint, basically, finding out ways of escape, figuring out how each person relates, trying to, you know, where's the money, where's this, where's that, what's my way through this situation. So all of Act 1 and most of Act 2 is quite shattered in that way. And then towards the end, it opens up as she finally figures out why she's the way that she is into just literally clear blue sky.
This actually premiered in London, correct? It was originally done in London. What is the same or what has changed since bringing it to New York?
I would say it's 95% the same. The thing that I always have to remind people is that a grand opera or any opera is not like theater, where you have an endless period of previews during which you can make changes, and that's part of the culture of that yeah. work, is that you can fold in changes, you know, script changes the morning of, and then you do it that night, and you have an audience in, and you learn so much by experiencing the piece in real time with everything working with an audience. And with an opera, you don't have that until the week you open. It's just not part of how the schedule works. And you have, you know, you'll have time on stage with things that are being kind of slowly layered in, but it's not the whole thing. So both in London and here, we had one time before we opened to really see the whole thing from beginning to end with an
audience. That's a little terrifying.
It's beyond terrifying. So there were a lot of things that, you know, during the show in London, I'm sitting there thinking like, oh my God, this proportion is weird. And you can't know it until mm-hmm. it's up there. And I think, you know, historically, no one knows it either.
What was something during that 5-year process, though, that you knew wasn't going to work and you got rid of? Or something you knew that needed to come in.
There was nothing that was a nightmare from the beginning. As in, but for
instance,
it
didn't work. You know,
I can tell you exactly what didn't work. So at the end of Act One, there's this violent sexual assault that her husband and captor does to her on a boat. Curtain, and then Act Two. After Act Two opens a few weeks later, and they're sort of pretending that everything's all right, in a way that we thought was going to be dramatically successful. In as much as that's kind of, you know, pretending that things are all right was her strategy to kind of get out of this situation. But we realized that we needed to mark that with both text and music. So there's a 3.5-minute new piece of music there. And that we figured out after the London show. That was very easy. But about 3 weeks ago, or maybe let's say 3 weeks before we opened, we were sitting and watching this thing and thought, there's an extra beat at the end. There's an extra beat where we're telling, not showing. And, you know, the way that we started doing it was fussing with it and changing this and moving that and new line here, and it just didn't work. And then we just kind of looked around and thought, what if we just got rid of it and let's just see? And we ran that sequence, and it was great. So those things you happen at different time scales, which is to say, you know, a big plan, remove the aria, or add an aria, and then a little kind of spontaneous plan. And I think it's good to have a collaborative team that's willing to work that way.
Absolutely.
And it's not just us, it's, you know, the singers who memorize it. And Isabel, who sings for like an hour and 45 minutes, you know, it's, I mean, obviously a cut is easier, but you know, it's like we all have to be a team.
We're speaking with Nico Muhly. He's the composer of Marnie. It's at the Met through November 10th. And you mentioned 36-year-old mezzo-soprano Isabel Leonard stars as Marnie in this production. She's one of the most acclaimed opera singers of her generation,
awesome.
Of your generation. Yep. She's awesome, as you said. What does she bring to the role that you sometimes just, it floors you? You think like, ah, oh, she just has it.
So Isabel, first of all, I mean, I need to start by saying she's an extraordinary musician and she's an extraordinary collaborator. But the other thing that she does and that she can capitalize on as an actor and as a singing actor, how to play various registers of enigmaticness, right? Where it's not just, it's not bold strokes. And she's willing to work in very small details, both in terms of vocal production and in terms of facial production and body language. And when I say small, I mean very small, but it somehow communicates to the back of the Met, which is, you know, a 3,800 seat wow. auditorium. And that to me is really special. So it doesn't feel like she's ever kind of throwing big gestures of paint around. It layers and it gets better and better. So it's not like she decides that she's going to do it this way and then that's it. There's always progress and it, you know, and exponential progress.
And nuance, it sounds
and nuance.
Like.
That's
exactly.
So exactly. And for me as a composer, you know, I would never ask her, I would never say do exactly this because that's the effect. You know, what I'm doing is it's a set of instructions, but I don't want to go crazy. And I want to create room for her to actually do that work that she's so good at. And the same with Michael Mayer, which is, you know, it's about setting up an environment in which she can do that, in which she can shine. So it's not us just being like, this is a top-down production. What we say is right. You layer it together.
Before you go, I have to ask you about Tippi Hedren coming to see the show. The original Marnie.
It was a surprise. I mean, it was a strange kind of fuguing of the fact that, you know, of course we did the book and not the film. But, you know, first of all, she took a bunch of us aside and said, you know, the filming of this movie was incredibly difficult for me. And she had given an interview a few years ago about how Hitchcock sexually assaulted her during the.
Right.
During the making of it. And one of the things that I was nervous about is that we represent this kind of male oppressive energy by having 10 silent dancers who are always surrounding her and always kind of getting up in her face. And I, you know, it's the kind of thing that if you've gone through that sort of emotional and physical turmoil, even though it's in the 60s, that you know, watching it on stage kind of in a box at the Met must be very, very intense. But she was, I mean, she stayed at the after party like later than anyone else. She was super glam. She, you know, she works with big cats outside of LA. She has a wildlife preserve. Just a really interesting and powerful lady. And she, yeah, she was amazing. And she said, you know, in the movie, Marnie hates red, which is why I'm in this red dress. I thought, that is the way to do it. Like, when I'm however old she is, that's going to be my role, too.
That's so fierce. We have about a few seconds left. I always hate asking this question, but I always want to know the answer. After someone dumps something big, what's next?
I am going to South Carolina to premiere a bassoon concerto, which
a
is
what?
A bassoon concerto. Go!
I like the way you say it.
There are not very many of them, and I'm trying to add to the glorious tradition. But it's actually for me, that's a really emotionally satisfying thing to go from this gigantic thing with hundreds and hundreds of people, and then suddenly to something small and intimate and written for a friend and straightforward.
Nico Muhly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The name of the opera is Marnie, and it is playing at the Met through November 10th. We'll leave you with a little bit of it. You've been listening to all of it. I'm Allison Stewart, and we'll be back after the news.